All right. We are in 2 Kings chapter 7, if you want to try to find that with me. 2 Kings chapter 7. We are looking at the miracles of Elisha. Our study is on the kings of Israel and Judah. But right here in the beginning of the book of 2 Kings, basically there's a pause. It kind of shifts from the timeline of the kings to pretty much all the miracles of Elisha recorded in one lump here. So we left off with 2 Kings chapter 6 last week, where the king of Syria got frustrated about losing battles and sent his army down to capture Elisha, only for Elisha to pray down a blindness, a supernatural blindness, lead them back to Samaria, and then send them home. Well, then, you know, probably two or three years later, but a little while later, he sends his army back to siege Samaria. We talked last week about the food prices and the desperation of the people, that they were selling, you know, donkey's head and dove's dung at extremely high prices because they had nothing else to eat. The two women, you know, agreed to boil their children. It was just a terrible situation. Okay. Then we pick up in chapter 7, verse 1, then Elisha said, "Hear you the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and two measures of barley for a shekel, in the gate of Samaria." Now remember, Samaria is the city that's been under siege. They're so depleted that they have nothing. You know, they're the ones that have been selling donkey's head for, you know, 2-3 months' salary. And the prophecy here is that food will be at, you know, greatly discounted prices. Verse 2, then the Lord on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, "Behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, might this thing be?" And that phrase, windows in heaven, is used typically in the scriptures of miraculous provision. He said, you know, even if God did a miracle, that wouldn't happen, is basically what he's saying. Verse 3, there were four leprous men at the entering into the gate, and they said one to another, "Why sit we here until we die? If we say we will enter into the city, the famine's in the city, we'll die there. If we sit here, we die. Now therefore, come and let us fall into the host of the Syrians. If they save us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die." My paraphrase, we're going to die anyway. Verse 5, they rose up in the twilight to go into the camp of the Syrians. And when they were come to the uttermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. For the Lord had made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said one to another, "Lo, the king of Israel hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. Wherefore they arose and fled in the twilight, and left their tents and their horses, their asses, their camp as it was, and fled for their life." And when these lepers came to the uttermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and did eat and drink, and carried thence silver and gold and raiment, and went and hid it, and came again and entered into another tent and carried thence also and went and hid it. Now, is anything about that behavior unusual? I mean, they said, "We're going to die if we sit here and starve to death. We go in the city, we're going to starve to death and die. So if we go over to Syria and they kill us, we're going to die anyway, but maybe they'll be nice to us. Maybe they'll throw us some scraps." Well, when they got there, they found it was deserted. So what did they do? They had something to eat. It's exactly what you would do, right? How many of you, you know, were, you know, you tried to be good and not eat much on Thursday morning so you could, you know, eat a big meal, you know, on Thursday lunch, right? Okay, that was, I did fairly well to hold off until the big dinner. But, you know, that was what, a few hours? And, you know, we didn't eat till like 1 or 1:30, which is after the time I normally eat. So, I'm starting to, you know, get lightheaded and shakes. No, I'm exaggerating. But, you know, we feel that way sometimes. I'm 2 or 3 hours past my normal meal time. I'm going to die. It's probably been weeks since these guys had anything substantive to eat. Okay, so when they show up and nobody's around and there's food, what did they do? They sat down and ate. The same thing you did when you were finally told, "All right, let's gather around the table. It's time to eat." You know, they filled up a plate and they had at it. They had seconds. They filled themselves up. There's nothing unusual really about that. It's human nature. But, and then what they did is they took the gold, silver, and the raiment, the valuables, and went and hid it. Now, are you picturing this in your mind? What are these lepers going to do with this? I mean, in Israel, what happened with the lepers? Why were they outside the city to start with? Because they weren't allowed to intermingle with the population. Okay, they were medically unclean, religiously unclean. It was considered, it was a contagious condition that was considered incurable. So they were outside the city. Everybody else was inside the city walls for protection. Where are the lepers? They're left outside. If they die, oh well, you know, they're going to die anyway. So, you know, they're left to fend for themselves. But what I'm saying is they go hide this gold and silver. What good's it going to do them? They can't say, woohoo, now we can pay the doctors and we can get a cure. There was no cure for leprosy. But it's human nature, right? I got some. I'm going to, you know, try to hang on to it. You know, maybe it's like, okay, I can't work a job because of my leprosy. Maybe I can put this up and give it to my wife and kids or, you know, whatever. But they went and hit it, and then they come back and do that again. Verse 9, then it kind of hits them. You know, what's going on here? Then they said one to another, we do not well. This day is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come, that we may go and tell the king's household. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Who was it that's left them outside the city to die? You know, those same people. But they realized, hey, we have an obligation to these people to share the good news with them. They said, if something happens to us tonight and we never get to deliver the message tomorrow, we're going to be in trouble. And they're going to be in trouble. Now, even though they were lepers and they were ostracized, they still had a concern for, this would have been their neighbors, probably their family, you know, their friends. They had a concern for them. They didn't want to see them die of starvation, but they all realized that that was a very real possibility at this point. But, you know, they it just hit them. Wait a minute, what are we doing? You ever had those moments? What am I doing? Here, it was a realization of, it's not just about us. There's enough here for everybody. And we ought to share this. Now, this was an actual story. Is there an application here? I mean, this ought to be a pretty easy application, I would think. They said it's a day of good tidings. What does the word gospel mean? Good tidings or good news? Okay? To preach the gospel comes from a word that means, you know, to preach the good news or to share the good news. I mean, could we make an application for us today? I think, yeah, that'd be pretty easy. This is a day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. In other words, if we procrastinate, we might lose the opportunity to share this. We better share it now while we have a chance. This is this time is the tract distribution emphasis for our church. As a reminder of the urgency of sharing the gospel. Is the gospel good news? Yeah. Is it better news than Thanksgiving dinner to starving people? Yeah. And yet, you know, we still sometimes, you know, have the tendency to get tied up with our duties, right? Or our situations, our needs. None of that's bad. I mean, we have responsibilities to take care of our, you know, jobs, take care of our family, all those things. But sometimes we get tied up and we need to just stop and realize, wait a minute, we do not well. We need to share this good news while we have an opportunity. I mean, how long do we have to share the good news? When is Jesus returning? Let me hit Google real quick. Some nut has made a prediction. And I guess the theory is if you make enough predictions, one of them hits, right? But, you know, we don't know. We have never known. And every generation since the time of the apostles has been under the impression that, you know, it could be at any point in time. I mean, we can look at prophecies that have been fulfilled and things that have kind of come together and say, you know, it seems like there's far more pieces that have come together in our day and not really much that needs to happen before the Lord could return and other events could fall into place with world events, world politics, that kind of thing. In other words, how long do we have? We don't know. So that means we should procrastinate or we should have a sense of urgency. I mean, we know the answer to that. We should have a sense of urgency in sharing the good news. The lepers here were focused on themselves, and they're like, wait a minute, no. We need to share this with everybody. And isn't it easy to do that with salvation and the worship of the Lord? And, you know, we try to focus on having a personal walk with God and having a prayer time and, you know, the things that we ought to do. And sometimes it's easy just to kind of get more tunnel vision on that. And wait a minute, no, I need to, you know, lift up my eyes and see the fields. I need to see the harvest. Here the leper said, we do not well. This day is the day of good tidings and we hold our peace. Verse 10, so they came and called unto the porter of the city and they told him, we came to the camp of the Syrians, and behold, there's no man there. Neither the voice of man, but horses tied and asses and the tents as they were. All right, now, what would you be thinking if you got this report? How long have they been under siege in Samaria? I mean, if they're down to the point where they're selling, you know, donkey's heads, and they have nothing of any food value left to share, it's been months, right? Possibly a couple of years. It's been a very long time. They realize that, you know, they're had. They have no outlet. They have no help. God had miraculously caused the army of Syria to hear things. You ever done that? Been home by yourself and hear things? You're just sure that you heard something and you go check it out and all of that. I mean, sometimes it's just annoying, and sometimes, you know, it really can stimulate your adrenaline, right? You're just sure you heard somebody in the house or whatever. What God stimulated them in such a way that they thought they heard an oncoming army. They were just sure that mercenaries had been hired against them, and they were outnumbered, and they just ran for it. But when they went to the gate and they called for the porter, they called for the attendant, and they relayed the message. Now, if you hear, hey, the Syrians have left. They left everything. Their camp's empty. There's part of you that wants to believe that. And then there's part of you that's like, that's too good to be true. Right? That's too good to be true. This has got to be a trick. This has got to be a scam. Well, they went and told the king. Verse 12, the king arose in the night. So it sounds like, you know, by the time it was getting dark, by the time they decided, hey, we need to go back and share the message. And so, you know, it's nighttime, they get back, and they decide, well, do we wake up the king or don't we? Yeah, we better wake up the king just in case. The king arose, verse 12, in the night and said to his servants, I'll show you what the Syrians have done to us. They know we're hungry. Therefore, they've gone out of the camp to hide themselves in the field, saying, when they come out of the city, we'll catch them alive and get into the city. I mean, I understand that. Militarily, I understand it. You know, just from the standpoint of paranoia at that point, I understand it. But at the same time, why wouldn't you take a chance on that, right? Verse 13, one of the servants said, let some take, I pray thee, five of the horses that remain which are left in the city. Behold, there is all the multitude of Israel that are left in it. Behold, they're saying even as all the multitude of the Israelites that are consumed. In other words, what he's saying is, if we lose five horses, they're all about to die just like the people are. That's what he's saying. And let us send and see. So did the king give them five? No, but he did give them two. Verse 14, they took therefore two chariot horses, and the king sent after the host of the Syrians, saying, go and see. And they went after them unto Jordan, and lo, all the way was full of garments and vessels, which the Syrians had cast away in their haste, and the messengers returned and told the king. The people went out and spoiled the tents of the Syrians. So in their fear, in their panic, they were, you know, lightening the boat all the way down, you know, all the way down the trail to the river. They're running away, they're hearing noises, and they're running in a panic. So the people went out and spoiled the tents of the Syrians. What does that spoiled mean? Does that mean it's like the milk that's, you know, 3 weeks past date and you take the cap off the jug? No, spoil means to take captive or to capture or to claim as your own. Okay? To be spoiled means that you were captured or you were claimed as someone else's prize. Okay? So they spoiled the tents of the Syrians. A measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel and two measures of barley for a shekel according to the word of the Lord. Okay? I don't have it on here. But this goes right back to the prophecy of Elisha, in verse 1. Remember, I told you last week that a cab of dove's dung, which is somewhere between, you know, the size of a Rubik's Cube, depending on one Bible dictionary, encyclopedia that I read, maybe a quart, dry measure, four cups, you know, something like that. That was sold for 5 shekels. Okay? Here, it says a measure of fine flour was sold for a shekel. Right? A measure, again, if you read, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 Bible encyclopedias, you're going to get slightly different. But I took International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, which is, you know, a standard reference. But using that, a measure is equivalent to about 1.5 pecks, our measures, or 10 quarts, dry measure, 10 cups. Okay? So, as opposed, you know, you get 2 to 4 cups of dove's dung for 5 shekels, or you get, what's 10 times 4? 40 cups of fine flour for 1 shekel. All right? The price has gone way down and the quality has gone way up. This is exactly what that one servant of the king had said was impossible. Fine flour was sold for a shekel and 2 measures of barley, which would have been, you know, not the higher quality, but, you know, there's more of it. So in other words, that would be the ramen noodles of the day, I guess. Verse 17, the king appointed the Lord on whose hand he leaned to have the charge of the gate. And the people trod on him in the gate, and he died, as the man of God had said, who spake when the king came down to him. And it came to pass, as the man of God had spoken to the king, saying, 2 measures of barley for a shekel, and a measure of fine flour for a shekel, so shall be tomorrow about this time in the gate of Samaria. And that Lord answered the man of God, now behold, if the Lord should make windows in heaven, might such a thing be? And he said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not eat thereof. So it fell out unto him, for the people trode upon him in the gate, and he died. The very man that said, that's impossible. If God can't do that big a miracle, is what he meant when he said, if God opens the windows of heaven, could this thing be? In other words, even a miracle of God wouldn't bring about what you're talking about, Elisha. And Elisha says, all right, fine, you're going to see it, but you're not going to participate in it. Now, it says the people trod on him in the gate, and he died. You think that was an angry mob? You think they hated this guy? I don't think so. I think they were starving. They were literally starving to death. And when they heard there was food and the story was verified, they, you know, this guy was supposed to be in the gate. He was supposed to, all right, now let's have order. It's like the poor slacker whose job it is to, you know, unlock the doors on the Black Friday morning at 5 a.m. at the store, right? You ever seen videos of that? You know, in certain instances I've seen videos of that where, you know, there's a whole line standing at the door and the poor employee is just trying to get out alive. You know, Walmart, they used to, I did not venture out to Walmart on Black Friday, but they used to put pallets, you know, in the aisleways. And the workers would be bringing out pallets, and people would be tearing at the plastic wrap before they even stopped and, you know, took it off the pallet jack. And we're like, wow, that's bad manners. This is far worse. This was manslaughter. They trampled the man to death. They were so hungry that they ran him over. Get out of the way. Stampeded him to death. That was the judgment of God. God had, through his spokesman Elisha, had said, all right, fine. If you're not willing to believe me, I'm going to show you to prove that I can do it. But I'm not going to let you participate in the blessing. Now, that's, you know, that was an actual story. We're talking about Samaria. The king is still an idolater. These are not people that are believers in God. Okay? Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. They all worshipped the golden calves of Jeroboam or the Baal in some form or fashion. They were all idolaters. But I do think there's an application for you and me here as well. I mean, here, the man that refused to believe God was told, all right, fine, you're going to see what God can do, but you're not going to participate in any of the blessing. I'd hate to be in that position, wouldn't you? I would not want to be told, all right, fine, you know, I'm going to show you just to see, but you don't get to personally enjoy any of the blessing. That'd be awful. I mean, the man died starving hungry, right? Trampled to death is an awful way to go. But as he's dying, he also realizes, I was completely wrong. Remember, this is an idolatrous man that said, your God, Elisha, can't do this. And God says, all right, just fine. Step back, watch, see what I can do. Now, this is a rhetorical question, but still, I think it ought to make us think. Do you want to enjoy the blessings of God? Or do you want to miss out on the blessings of God? mean, we think about Christmas time coming. You know, depending, we're in the age bracket now where we're more, you know, kind of handing out gifts to the kids and stuff like that. But, you know, you still hope there's at least one with your name on it, right? Do you want the blessings of God to be handed out and there's no package with your name on it? And you're like, okay, very funny. Everybody's open there. Okay, joke's on me. All right, it's fine. Where's the present? No, there isn't one. I mean, it would be the New Testament equivalent to that would be probably, you know, 1 Corinthians 3, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble, and having everything consumed, having nothing of lasting value. But here, the blessings of God were present, and he completely missed out on it. I don't want to be there, and I know you don't. Why did he miss out on the blessings of God? Because he refused to believe God. He mocked the word of God. But simply, if I could just boil it down more simply, he refused to believe the promise of God through God's spokesman. Is that not what the New Testament says when it says you have not because ye... Sometimes we miss out, and it's our own fault. But you see here, the prophecy of Elisha was fulfilled and the judgment on the Lord. All right, now that brings us to chapter 8. And we're told here, Elisha prophesied a famine, but really, this one was, it seems like this story is primarily about the Shunammite woman. Verse 1, Then spake Elisha unto the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, Arise, go thou and thine household, and sojourn wherever thou canst sojourn, for the Lord hath called for a famine, and it shall come upon the land 7 years. And the woman arose and did after the saying of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. It came to pass at 7 years' end that the woman returned out of the land of the Philistines, and she went forth to cry unto her king for her house and for her land. So what had happened while she was gone? They had sold it, or somebody else had claimed it. You know, the kinsman redeemer had claimed it, or it had been sold at auction. It had been claimed for unpaid taxes and sold. You know, that would be the modern day equivalent of that, right? But she lost her property 7 years. Now, the timing of this is very puzzling to me, I'm going to be honest, because of verse 4, the king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. Anybody else remember what happened to Gehazi a couple chapters ago? Doc, go ahead. What happened? Yeah, he lied to Naaman and took money that God did not want taken. And so Elisha said, the leprosy of Naaman's on you. So why is the king talking to Gehazi at this point? I mean, are they talking at a great distance with, you know, double masking? Or did this story chronologically come first? I don't really know. Can't really sort that out. But the king is talking with Gehazi. And so at this point, apparently Gehazi was able to interact. I don't know. Maybe Gehazi repented, but it seems to me like chapter 5 says, the last verse of chapter 5 says, the leprosy of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and to thy seed forever. So it seems like that was a permanent judgment on Gehazi. So maybe this story chronologically comes first. But we're given the story here in chapter 8. But the king talked with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, Tell me, I pray thee, all the great things that Elisha hath done. Human nature is human nature. People like to hear stories about great accomplishments or, you know, fantastic things. Hey, tell me some stories about what the things that Elisha has done. Verse 5, it came to pass as he was telling the king how he had restored a dead body to life. That would go back to chapter 4 when Shunammite woman had placed her son in the prophet's chamber upstairs and gone to find Elisha and refused to accept the servant. No, Elisha, you're coming with me. It was that story. That behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life, middle of verse 5, cried to the king for her house and for her land. And Gehazi said, My lord, O king, this is the woman, and this is her son, whom Elisha restored to life. And when the king asked the woman, she told him. Is that true? Yeah, she told him the story. So the king appointed unto her a certain officer, saying, Restore all that was hers, and all the fruits of the field since the day that she left the land, even until now. Well, that's a bonus. She got all the benefits of the farm without having worked the farm for the last 7 years. All of the harvest or all of the sales from the produce and such. But it seems like this story about the famine is, you know, primarily included to talk about, you know, God's continued blessing on the Shunammite woman. Now, the Shunammite woman is the one that had, you know, gone to her husband and said, hey, you know, there's a man of God passing by here. Can we build him, you know, a little chamber? And her care for the prophet Elisha, you know, seems to have continued to result in God's blessing on her, you know, as a result of that. All right? So you have here the story of the Shunammite woman. And then in the rest of chapter 8, you have the prophecy of the death of the king of Syria. Verse 7, Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick, and it was told him, saying, the man of God has come hither. Now, what else have we seen previously about Ben-Hadad and Elisha? This is the same guy that sent his army to encircle the city to capture him. He was so mad that Elisha kept spoiling his military plans and telling the king of Israel what was happening. He sent his army down there to capture Elisha. Elisha took this man's army, walked them into the capital of Samaria, and then said, Lord, open their eyes. They saw where they were, and then sent them home. It's the same guy. Okay. This is not a believer in the God of heaven by any stretch. But he respected the power of God that was evident in the life of Elisha. Verse 8, the king said to Hazael, take a present in thine hand, and go and meet the man of God, and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, shall I recover of this disease? Now, when you read that, don't read any further just yet. When you read that, take a present in thine hand, what do you think of? I mean, we think of a present, we typically think of, you know, some sort of a box or something wrapped up with something in it. But, you know, when Saul said, let's take a present to the seer and maybe he can help us, what was the present? It was some wild honey and some figs, you know, and that kind of thing. You know, so it was usually relatively small. When David was getting ready to kill Nabal, Abigail showed up with a little bit larger present because she had to feed 600 men of David. She had several animals that she loaded down with food. But when we think take a present, we would think something like that, something probably that you can carry or maybe put on one animal. You know, that it was sometimes gold or silver. Sometimes it was food, gifts. Look at the present that Hazael took, verse 9. So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him of every good thing of Damascus. What's the next phrase? 40 camels burden. I mean, the camels were already the vehicles of the wealthy, if you will. They were the SUVs, you know, not the Honda Fit or the Prius, you know. But how much did Abraham's servant take when he went to find a bride for Isaac? I believe that was 10 camels, okay? 40 camels burden is a whole lot. Okay? I've been around camels in a zoo setting. Okay, I've not been to Israel or seen the settings there. But I mean, you know, it's a big animal. You know, if they want to strap it down, they could carry, you know, quite the load if they were going to bundle things up. 40 camels burden. I mean, if I'm going to put it in modern day terminology, this is multiple 15 passenger vans with the seats out filled up. Okay. This was not a, you know, here's a coffee mug, thanks for visiting kind of a gift, okay? This was an enormous present. This shows tremendous respect. This is the kind of gift a king could give, but this also shows how desperate they were, the king was, to find out, am I going to die or am I going to live, okay? So he took 40 camels burden and came and stood before him and said, thy son, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, hath sent me to thee. That's a different tone of voice, isn't it? Thy son, Ben-Hadad? This is the same Ben-Hadad that ordered the army to go kill him. This is humble. This is respectful. This is a totally different tone. Thy son, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, hath sent me to thee, saying, shall I recover of this disease? Verse 10, Elisha said unto him, Go, say unto him, Thou mayest certainly recover. Howbeit, the Lord has showed me that he shall surely die. And he settled his countenance steadfastly until he was ashamed. And the man of God wept. Can you picture that? What does that mean? He settled his countenance steadfastly. He's trying his best to bite his lip, you know, rub his face. And he's trying to keep his composure. Finally, it says he wept. Verse 12, Hazael said, Why weepeth my Lord? Then he answered, Because I know the evil that thou wilt do unto the children of Israel. Their strongholds wilt thou set on fire, and their young men wilt thou slay with a sword, and will dash their children and rip up their women with child. Hazael said, But what? Is thy servant a dog that he should do this great thing? He said, I would never do anything like that. Elisha answered, The Lord has showed me that thou shalt be king over Syria. So he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said unto him, What said Elisha to thee? And he said, He told me that thou shouldest surely recover, which was true. Verse 15, It came to pass on the morrow that he took a thick cloth, dipped it in water, and spread it on his face so that he died. And Hazael reigned in his stead. It's interesting. It is, but it's also not everything about having the Lord reveal things to Elisha was big and bombastic and exciting, right? Here, you know, the word of the Lord, the revelation of the Lord came with a great burden. The king, earlier in chapter 8, the king of, in Samaria, would be the king of Israel, had said, Hey, tell me the great stories, and we like those things. But here, there was, you know, great burdens that went with it as well. He said, No, you're going to be the next king of Syria. And, you know, I know what you're going to eventually do to Israel. That was great, your weight, there was a great burden here. So he went and he smothered the king of Syria to death. I mean, assassination is as old as human population, right? All the way back to Cain and Abel. But here, this has nothing to do directly with Israel. This has to do with Syria, a neighboring country. Why would God allow his prophet to deal with them? They're not even Israelites. Why would God allow his prophet to deal with them? Because God is the God of the whole world. Because God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Okay? Jew first, and also to the Greek. I mean, we tend to think, you know, very tribally sometimes. Well, it's, you know, it's Israel, and God should deal with them. Or, you know, it's America, and, you know, this is where God's working, or whatever. But God was willing to deal with Syria, too, if they were willing to respond. The rest of the chapter, verse 16, the fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, Jehoshaphat being then king of Judah, you have kind of, we're going back on the timeline now, okay? The events in the rest of chapter 8 deal with things that we've already covered on the king's timeline. This is kind of backing up to 2 Kings chapter 1 and 2, and, you know, the events there on the timeline. Now it kind of, the story kind of blends back in to where we left off with the kings. In chapters 1 and 2, you had Elijah calling down, you know, fire from heaven, devouring the 50 and the 50, and you had the River Jordan parted, and Elijah caught up on a whirlwind, Elisha saying, Where's the Lord God of Elijah? And then the focus kind of shifted off of that to all the miracles. But now we're kind of coming back to the history of it, and the rest of chapter 8 kind of leads into the timeline that we had previously been looking at, okay? In chapter 9, verse 1, Elisha the prophet called one of the children of the prophets and said, Gird up thy loins and take this box of oil and go to Ramoth-Gilead. When thou comest hither, look out Jehu, the son of Jehoshaphat, the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise from among his brethren and carry him into an inner chamber. So chapter 9 shifts back to the anointing of Jehu, and it's going to shift back to the kings then. That is basically where we left off previously before we looked at the miracles. We left off with Ahaziah and, you know, said when we left off with the study of Ahaziah, we said that Jehu was given the task to get rid of the house of Ahab, and he did that. Jehu, his dynasty would be one of the longest dynasties, his family, but of the northern kingdom. It wasn't, you know, too terribly long, but of the northern kingdom, there were four main families, and Jehu's dynasty was the longest. So we're kind of shifting back on the timeline there, which wraps up this section on the miracles of Elijah and Elisha. Tremendous application, I think, in a lot of ways, but I think particularly in chapter 7 and 8, the application for you and me, why sit we here until we die? And you're going to see it, but you're not going to partake of it. I think tremendous challenge for you and me to trust God, to trust His Word, but also to share the good news that we have. Theirs was good news of survival. There was food. They didn't have to starve to death. Our good news is the gospel of eternal life. And in these stories, New Testament might call them parables, but these aren't actually parables, they're real-life stories. In these real-life stories, we see tremendous spiritual lessons for you and me. So this will kind of wrap up the miracles of Elisha, and then next week we will look at Jehu and jump back into the study of the line of the kings. All right, let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord.